The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Hope you guys are all doing well. We're at like mid-July right now as this episode is going to drop. Middle of the summer, how are we all feeling? Pulse check. I guess not everyone is in a super warm climate right now. But for those of us who are we hanging in there? Are we going crazy? I honestly have been feeling a bit brain foggy recently, and I have to say I have to blame it on the heat. So hopefully I can share this story in a good, succinct way and not just like go off on many little tangents as I do, because honestly, I've been catching myself doing that recently. And I'm like, God, I got to drink a glass of water or something. This heat is crazy, especially here in the city where there's like really nowhere to go besides just like the subway, where I swear to God, I go down in the subway. I feel like I'm getting a free sauna subscription. Like I don't need to get like or purchase credits and go to like the saunas and steam rooms. I kind of get them confused. Just go downstairs into the subway station and you have a free one right there for you. Anyway, I digress. We're going to get into a story today. I came up with the idea for this one to look into the history of the hoax and talk about famous hoaxes, essentially stories that are, you know, to our knowledge, untrue, but have been talked about for so long that we were starting to think like maybe this is true, you know, like the Bigfoot conspiracy, all those things, like little stories from history that are actually so, so interesting. We'll be sharing today in this episode. But I kind of stumbled into this concept of like the history of the hoax, honestly, through just spending a lot of time on TikTok, on social media, and just seeing how people love to share tall tales or just tales in general, but we don't know which of them are tall tales. Like when I hear an absolutely crazy, very personal story on TikTok, my first inclination is to believe them. And then as I start to hear like everything else and read the comments and maybe see at least one naysayer that's like, this could be fake or fabricated, I then start to accept the idea that not everything I hear is true. But how am I to know that? Or how is anyone to know that? And why do people even lie to begin with or fabricate these stories, kind of come up with these tall tales? Like, why do people do that anyway? So that's how things kind of got started. The gears were turning with my idea to do this episode today, which honestly, I thought at first it might be a dud topic that like we kind of start to research. Sarah and I, I'm my lovely researcher, and we're kind of just like, this isn't good. Like it's just not going anywhere. But I was blown away by these little stories. It's kind of like a few or like a smattering of like a few handful of micro tales today in this episode that will just really make you scratch your head and think, wow, how do people believe that? So yeah, that is where we're going with this episode today. I hope you guys enjoy it. And I think without further ado, let's just get on into things. So as I was first dipping my toe into this topic of hoaxes and, you know, debunking what exactly is a hoax and just thinking about any sort of like false claims or stories that I've heard, and honestly just thinking about which are the worst ones I've heard. Because obviously you hear stories that are untrue and they're debunked as being untrue. You know, the whole TV show of Mythbusters kind of is in this grain. But some of them you're like, okay, I kind of like had a feeling that wasn't true from the get-go. Like, come on. I mean, who's going to be dumb enough to believe that? You know, obviously I'm saying this as a super gullible person myself. I'm very gullible and I believe pretty much everything I hear unless I'm like told otherwise. It's a bad quality, but it's also just me being like, I just think everyone is telling the truth all the time. I think I'm optimistic, I guess, that people are good, you know? But one specific hoax that lives rent-free in my mind, like that I think about often and I'm always stressed about and really has directed the way that I use my phone, because I've heard this story like not just one time, several times, where I mean, there's many variations of this where you get a text from someone that you think is either your bank or, you know, a service or website you use quite a lot that you think like, oh, this is, I mean, the ones that I hear that are like the most detrimental, the worst are like when you think it's your bank, like Bank of America, for example, that's my bank. Like you think you're getting a text from Bank of America saying like, there's fraud on your account, click here to, you know, fix things. And then they ask for your PIN. And then all of a sudden, like if you are just gullible enough, you'll be handing over all of your information to a hacker. But so that's one that I think of, but one that I think is even worse than that, that is all rooted in a hoax in the sense that it's just so not true. But, you know, someone, if you're put in a certain position, you are likely to believe. Like, for example, when someone starts at a new job, maybe they're an intern or something, and they get a text from a person that claims to be their boss saying, hey, so-and-so, I know it's only your like second day on the job, but do you mind going and using the company card or your own card and take out, you know, $500 worth of gift cards for, you know, clients of ours or something. And they come up with it. It sounds so real. And I've heard this from a friend of mine who's actually done this, like did this when they were an intern. And like just, you know, they believed that this was their boss. And of course, if your boss tells you to do something, especially when you're 2 days into the job, you don't want to mess it up. So you go and you take the company card and you buy like, you know, $1,000 worth of gift cards. And they ask you to give them the numbers. Like, oh, wait, they'll be like, get the gift cards, then write down the numbers, the PIN numbers and whatever, and send it back to me so I can verify or so I can send it. Something like just so mastermindy in the worst possible way, and people go through with it. And that is in itself a very good example or a very sad example of a hoax. And you know, the person, the intern, is then left feeling very stupid, but also they really in their, like to their core, believed that this was true. So that kind of gives you an idea, like an example idea of what a hoax is. But a hoax, in its definition, is a deliberate act of deception designed to trick people into believing something that is false. Hoaxes, they can take many different forms, like false claims, fake news, staged events, or fabricated documents, just to name a few examples. And the intention behind a hoax is often to mislead, create confusion, or generate publicity. So a publicity stunt, for example, could be or is an example of a hoax. And I've been seeing a lot of claims on social media, like specifically TikTok. I've been trying to keep up with all of these. You know, there's a lot of storytelling, like 17 part, you know, videos where it's like part one, part two, part three. And it all relates to something like deeply personal that a person is talking about. And, you know, you'll often see a comment claiming, oh, this is definitely a publicity stunt. Like this is definitely like this relationship is fake, or this is, you know, people love to say this is a publicity stunt. That is an example of a hoax if it is actually a publicity stunt. A lot of times it isn't, but they're so unbelievable that they're believable sometimes, a hoax. So hoaxes have been around for centuries and really cover a lot of ground in terms of their subject matter. The first recorded records of hoaxes can be found from at least the 1600s when, you know, at the time, maybe there were some very crude newspapers and like ways of, you know, sending around information, handwritten bulletins and things. But for the most part, it was very much like word of mouth. People were, you know, did you hear about that? Did you see that? Or like, you know, and it was kind of hard to fact check these things and to debunk whether or not this person, you know, really saw a UFO or whatever. I mean, granted, the 1600s, maybe they didn't see, maybe they weren't sighting UFOs, but you know what I mean? Like things like that, where it's like, you kind of just believe the person that is telling you things. And it's not like, it might go from like, you know, a small circle to expand just over a slow period of time. It wasn't like fast, you know, spreading of information like on TikTok and on just like, you know, newspapers and TV today. Primarily in the 18th and 19th centuries, hoaxes focused on human abnormalities and oddities, and the widespread prevalence of hoaxes didn't let up from there. They continued well into the 20th century and beyond, and they were ultimately formulated to take advantage of the public at a time where they weren't able to fact check the media, like I said. And, you know, the stories that they were told, they weren't able to figure out if the person was telling the truth or not. They just kind of had to either believe it or don't believe it. But, you know, these days we whip out our phones and we hop on Google if we see something that sounds suspicious. But then, like, what recourse did they have? Like, if they were not the expert on a subject, who were they to question it? So ultimately, this just led to some super weird news stories back then, like, you know, giants in upstate New York, winged creatures living on the moon, mass zoo breakouts, you name it. There's a news article about it, slash just a tall tale that has been documented. So hoaxes have been happening for eons, but why? What possesses a person to lie in this way? What's the psychology behind the creation of a hoax, and why do people do it? I actually found an article from a psychologist named Mark D. Griffiths. He did an article on deception, where he essentially broke down a study that had been done that either he was a part of or someone he knows. He broke down 8 reasons why people create hoaxes and spread false stories knowingly. And when I read this, I was like, yes, 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 yes. Like this is, I can't think of a single other reason besides the ones that he debunked here. So number 1 is for amusement purposes. Number 2, out of boredom. Number 3, as an act of revenge. 4, as a way to gain fame or notoriety in some way. I think that that's a big one that's used, or like the reason for a lot of TikTok content. People want to go viral. Number 5, to gain attention. And he cited an example of like faking an illness, something like that. Number 6, I think it is. I lost count. Wait. 6, to demonstrate cleverness or perception of cleverness to others around them. 7, to disrupt the status quo. And finally, 8, for political causes, like claiming to be a victim of a hate crime, something like that, when you're not. Just an example. So now we know the why. And we know these kinds of people have been around for a while, obviously. But even in modern times, we have our own batch of famous hoaxes that I'm sure you're familiar with. You know, there's the very fun, like, historic ones that, you know, are just, we've all kind of heard of. But then there's some modern ones as well. Aside from the boss texting one that I talked about earlier, the most famous hoaxes are ones that fuel even more famous legends. Fabricated images of a creature in Loch Ness to swindle you into thinking there's a monster lurking in its depths. Bigfoot sightings in the northwestern U.S. to make you believe that you can't be alone in a forest without checking over your shoulder for a beast. And so many more. The first recorded sighting of a mysterious creature in the Loch Ness dates back to 565 AD. St. Columba, an Irish monk, was said to have encountered a large beast in the River Ness, which flows from Loch Ness. According to legend, St. Columba commanded the creature to stop its attack on a swimmer, and it listened. It obeyed, retreating back into the depths, and this story became part of local folklore. The legend remained relatively obscure until the early 20th century. In 1933, a new road was completed along the loch, providing an unobstructed view and increasing the number of visitors to the area. In April of that year, George Spicer and his wife reported seeing a large unknown animal cross the road in front of their car and disappear into the loch. This sighting, described as a long-necked creature with a bulky body, captured public imagination. And this is where the legend meets the hoax. So, to kind of debunk things, just like in very simple terms, like a hoax, obviously, is something that is false based on falseness, like just so much falseness. A legend is based on true historic events. So you know, it's maybe some hints and pieces or bits and pieces of a legend could be false and most likely are a lot of the time, but it's not entirely built on falsities, whereas a hoax is. Anyway, in 1934, the most famous piece of evidence surrounding the Loch Ness Monster emerged. It's called the Surgeon's Photograph. Taken by Robert Kenneth Wilson, a London gynecologist, the grainy black and white image appeared to show a long-necked creature emerging from the water. And for decades, this photo was considered the most compelling piece of evidence surrounding the Loch Ness Monster, or Nessie's, existence. However, in 1994, it was revealed to be a hoax. A cleverly staged photo using a toy submarine with a sculpted head and neck. So if the photo was fabricated, does that mean that the entire legend is as well? Next, we have Bigfoot. Sasquatch, the big beast lurking in the forest. You know the guy, like, you know, people call him different things. But this legendary being, Bigfoot, is said to be a large, hairy, two-legged beast shrouded in mystery and folklore. Long before European settlers arrived in North America, indigenous people had their own stories of large, mysterious creatures inhabiting the forests. Tribes across the continent, from the Coast Salish people of the Pacific Northwest to the Iroquois people in the Northeast, spoke of these giant human-like beings. These creatures were often seen as protectors of the forest or as omens, and their names varied. Sasquatch, the word Sasquatch, derives from a native term, Sisquak, meaning wild man. The modern era of the Sasquatch sightings began in the late 19th and early 20th century. Miners, lumberjacks, and hunters reported encounters with enormous hairy creatures in the wild. One of the earliest documented accounts came in 1924 when a group of miners near Mount St. Helens in Washington State claimed they were attacked by a group of, quote, ape men. Ape men, not to be confused with eight men. I know I didn't enunciate that well. In 1958, the legend gained significant attention when construction worker Jerry Crew found large footprints near Bluff Creek in California. He cast the prints, and the term Bigfoot was coined by the media. This incident sparked widespread interest in Bigfoot and led to numerous reports and investigations being launched. The most famous and controversial piece of Sasquatch Bigfoot evidence is the Patterson-Gimlin film shot in 1967. So Patterson-Gimlin, it's a mix of two different men's last names, Robert Patterson and Bob Gimlin. These two guys, they were horseback riding in Bluff Creek, California, when they captured a few seconds of footage of what appears to be a two-legged, large creature covered in dark hair. And the film has been analyzed and debated extensively since 1967, but most experts maintain that it's a hoax. These guys made it up. Furthermore, in 2002, a man named Ray Wallace, or rather his family, came forward and revealed that this guy had created fake Bigfoot footprints since the 1950s. So Ray Wallace, he created those fake footprints, but other hoaxes, other fake or falsities created surrounding the Bigfoot phenomenon. One happened in 2008 called the Georgia Bigfoot hoax, where two men claimed to have found a Bigfoot corpse that was later revealed to be a rubber suit. So this has kind of fueled the skeptics out there that are like, okay, any of the evidence that's been found so far could easily have been fabricated. Regardless of whether this hairy creature is truly fake or not, Bigfoot / Sasquatch has become a cultural icon. The creature appears in books, movies, TV shows, ads, symbolizing the wild, unexplored mysteries of nature. Festivals and conferences dedicated to Bigfoot draw enthusiasts from all over the world, and the creature has even become a mascot for various causes and campaigns. So these legends I just told you, you know, fueled by hoax after hoax, are very common. I'm willing to bet everyone has kind of heard of these before. So I'm more interested in the weird and wild hoaxes that we'll get into next that have misled, confused, and generated publicity all on their own. For example, have you guys heard the story of the Pacific Northwest tree octopus? According to Save the Pacific Northwest Tree Octopus's website, which has been around for almost 30 years, the Pacific Northwest tree octopus can be found in the temperate rainforests of the Olympic Peninsula on the west coast of North America. Their habitat lies on the eastern side of this Olympic mountain range, adjacent to Hood Canal. These solitary animals, their breed being a cephalopod, which essentially means they have tentacles, reach an average size measured from arm tip to mantle tip of 30 to 33 centimeters. And for my non-centimeter knowing people out there, like, I have no concept of what a centimeter is. That's like about 12, 13, 14 inches. Unlike most other cephalopods, tree octopuses are amphibious, so similar to like a frog or a toad, spending only their early life in a period of their mating season in the water.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Because of the moistness of rainforests and specialized skin adaptations that they've gone through time, these tree octopuses are able to keep from being, you know, just drying up, essentially, because they haven't been in the water for a while. Because you think of all these other creatures that are similar in their category of, you know, these cephalopods with their tentacles and whatnot being in the water. Like an octopus, like a traditional octopus that's like in the ocean, like could not survive out of water for very long. Whereas these tree octopuses have no problem with it. This is all based on the website, the Pacific Northwest Tree Octopus website. An intelligent and inquisitive being, the tree octopus explores its surroundings with both touch and sight. Adaptations its ancestors originally evolved in the three-dimensional environment of the sea have been put to good use in the spatially complex maze of the coniferous Olympic rainforests. The challenges and richness of the rainforest environment may account for the tree octopus's advanced behavioral developments. So from this paragraph, I think we can all agree that whoever wrote it is a smart person. Sounds scientific enough, smart enough. But what if I told you that this animal, the Pacific Northwest tree octopus, is endangered because it was being preyed on by Bigfoot? Yeah, that might kind of trigger to you that this is likely an internet hoax, which it is. The Pacific Northwest tree octopus is not a real thing, though a lot of people out there thought it was a real thing. It is a very famous internet hoax created in 1998 by a guy named Lyle Zapato. This site still remains active to this day for one primary purpose: online reliability education. In other words, teaching kids in schools how to decide whether or not a source is reliable, an internet source. You know, they are shown this website and told, you know, this factual, quote, factual information, only to then be told by their teacher or whoever that this is actually a load of crap. It's not true. In 2007, a group of researchers conducted a study on 13-year-old U.S. school children and their ability to critically evaluate online information websites like this one that was literally created with the sole purpose of testing people to, you know, be like, hey, you can't believe everything you read. You can't believe everything you see. So they did a legitimate study in 2007, including the top quartile of school children from Connecticut and South Carolina. And each kid was essentially exposed to the spoof site, Save the Northwest Pacific Tree Octopus, devoted to this, quote, rare species of octopus. You know, there are photos of the octopus that looked very real on the website and like in this, rainforest environment, looking very legit. And how did the kids respond, you might ask? Not as well as you'd hope. The study found that slightly more than half of school children that were interviewed in this reported that the website was very reliable. Each of the kids had just participated in a lesson that used this website to teach them to be suspicious, to be, you know, hesitant to believe everything they see online. So, and this group was young millennial, old Gen Z. So I wonder if, you know, maybe Gen Alpha would have been better luck since they are internet natives. But I encourage you to look at the website. It looks very legit. Like I was very surprised when I first saw it. But some hoaxes don't simply just mislead people. Some are merely meant to cause confusion. For example, the story of the spaghetti trees, which is perhaps the best April Fool's Day stunt ever because it was schemed up by the BBC, a widely trusted news source, obviously. Hence the mass confusion when the report of spaghetti trees surfaced on April 1st, 1957. So on that day, so April 1st, 1957, the BBC aired a segment on Panorama, a highly respected current affairs program, about the annual spaghetti harvest in the Swiss region of Ticino. The broadcast featured footage of a family harvesting long strands of spaghetti from trees and laying them out to dry in the sun. And it was all narrated by this very esteemed broadcaster named Richard Dimbleby, which also just added a layer of credibility to the prank. The report described how the mild winter, so like the weather conditions of winter, and the elimination pretty much of this animal called the spaghetti weevil. So apparently the cold winter, or the mild winter, the opposite of that, resulted in these weevils being pretty much, you know, decimated, and therefore the spaghetti was able to grow as it would any other year, but usually we don't see the spaghetti growing because of the spaghetti weevils that are eating it all before we can see it. So on the program, viewers saw women carefully plucking spaghetti strands from the trees and placing them in baskets, creating a seemingly authentic scene of a spaghetti harvest. The reaction was priceless. At the time, spaghetti was not a common dish in the United Kingdom, and many people were unfamiliar with how it was made. This also contributed to the believability of the prank. After the broadcast, the BBC received numerous phone calls from viewers wanting to know how they could grow their very own spaghetti trees. The BBC's response was to suggest that the person calling in place a sprig of spaghetti in a tin of tomato sauce and just hope for the best. Like, they would just stick it in there and hope that it would grow into a tree. Just imagine that. Imagine, like, people doing that and saying that they saw it on the BBC, so like, of course it has to be true, only to not realize that it was broadcast on April 1st, obviously April Fool's Day. How many people do you think planted a singular uncooked spaghetti noodle in a tin of sauce? Probably a lot, and the answer truly was a lot more than are willing to admit it. The prank was executed with such seriousness and attention to detail that it caught many viewers off guard, making it all the more memorable and humorous. And the spaghetti tree hoax is often cited as one of the greatest April Fool's Day pranks of all time. It highlighted the power of television and the trust people placed in respected media outlets. Granted, this was back in the 50s, so, you know, obviously people were kind of newer to television broadcasts and whatnot, but people really believed it. They trusted the BBC despite their confusion, and they followed this guidance with an inherent sense of trust, which really says a lot about the notoriety and dependability of the BBC. So that was a funny little tale that we found while researching. But moving on to another one, I told you it's gonna be a lot of micro stories in this episode that will leave you scratching your head. Moving on, we most commonly have hoaxes that are intended to generate publicity or attention, both good and bad. One of the most infamous hoaxes which garnered negative attention dates back to the 1700s. And this is the story, or the astonishing tale, rather, of Mary Toft, or as I like to call her, the Rabbit Lady. In the early 18th century, the Rabbit Lady's bizarre and incredible story captivated England. So we're still in the UK, we're still in England. And her tale remains one of the most peculiar medical hoaxes in history. Mary Toft was a poor, illiterate woman living in the town of Godalming, Surrey. In 1726, Mary claimed to have given birth to a series of rabbits. The story began when Mary, who was already pregnant, reportedly miscarried after being startled by a rabbit. Following the miscarriage, she started experiencing severe labor pains, which led to the supposed births of various animal parts and eventually whole rabbits. Gross, but more importantly, very weird, right? Mary's husband, Joshua Toft, and their neighbor, a local surgeon named John Howard, initially examined her and found her claims to be extraordinary. The surgeon, John Howard, was convinced of the authenticity of these events and sent letters to some of the most eminent medical professionals in London, including Nathaniel St. Andre, a surgeon to the royal household, and Sir Richard Manningham, a prominent obstetrician. So St. Andre, the legendary surgeon for the royal household, visited Mary Toft and witnessed her giving birth, quote-unquote, to several more rabbits. Amazed by what he saw, he wrote detailed accounts and presented them to King George I and his court, who were equally intrigued and mystified by this woman, Mary, giving birth to literal rabbits. Mary was then moved to London for further examination, where she continued to produce rabbits under the scrutiny of numerous doctors and scientists. Despite the initial belief in Mary's extraordinary claims, like people were believing her, skepticism soon began to grow. Sir Richard Manningham and other doctors started to doubt the legitimacy of the rabbit births. They conducted more rigorous examinations of Mary and closely monitored her, finding inconsistencies in her story and the impossibility of literally giving birth to rabbits based on medical knowledge. Eventually, a porter at the hospital where Mary was kept reported that he had been bribed to smuggle in baby rabbits. This revelation prompted a more thorough investigation, leading to the exposure of the hoax. Under intense pressure and scrutiny, Mary Toft confessed to the rabbit fraud. She admitted that she'd been manually inserting the rabbits into herself, later birthing them to make it look like she'd given birth to them. The motivation behind this elaborate, very kind of, I just like felt pain thinking of her doing that, deception was likely a mix of seeking attention and the desire to improve her family's impoverished situation. She must have thought that this ruse would somehow result in financial gain when someone with wealth, like the king, took pity on her for this crazy thing happening to her. However, the exposure of the hoax caused a public scandal and immense embarrassment for the medical professionals who had been duped. So it actually had the opposite effect than what Mary Toft had desired. The story was widely reported in the newspapers, becoming a subject of mockery and satire throughout England. And Mary Toft was briefly imprisoned for the fraud, but was eventually released without any severe punishment. But the tale of Mary Toft, the rabbit lady, remains a fascinating example of just how, you know, professionals even can be deceived by a well-crafted hoax. It highlights the lengths to which people will go for attention and virality and the willingness of society to believe the incredible. The incident also served as a cautionary tale for the medical community, emphasizing the need for skepticism and rigorous evidence in the practice of medicine. So while the story made Mary and the involved doctors look pretty bad, believe it or not, some hoaxes are intended to generate positive publicity. And one of my favorites in this category, my favorite stories in this category, is actually the tale of Naked Came the Stranger. So that's what I'm going to tell you next. So fast forward, we're now in the late 1960s. So we're no longer in the times of Mary Toft, and she's long dead by now. It's the 1960s, which was a time of social upheaval and cultural experimentation, as we know. And during this time, a group of journalists from the Long Island newspaper called Newsday hatched a plan to expose what they saw as a decline in literary standards. They believed that popular fiction had become formulaic and kind of superficial, with a focus on sensationalism rather than substance. Their idea was bold, mischievous, and rooted in satire. They would create a deliberately terrible novel filled with gratuitous sex and absurd plot lines to see if it could still become a bestseller, simply because it was a novel about sex and about, you know, like, so that was their mission, to see, to kind of test and learn and see if they could write like a really bad novel, but do it well in a way, like write something so bad that it like somehow became famous. The mastermind behind the scheme was a guy named Mike McGrady, a respected Newsday columnist. McGrady recruited 24 of his colleagues to each write a chapter for the book with the instruction to make it as bad as possible. The result was this book called Naked Came the Stranger, a novel about a woman named Jillian Blake who discovers her husband's infidelity and decides to embark on a series of sexual escapades herself. Jillian, the protagonist in the novel, hosts a radio show with her husband William. After uncovering his affair, she seduces a variety of characters in increasingly ridiculous situations, from a rabbi to a mobster. Each chapter, penned by a different author, features disjointed styles and over-the-top scenarios. So it's just bad. And the people that wrote it, all 24 of those, or 25 of those contributors, took pleasure in crafting the most outlandish and cringeworthy prose they could imagine. To give the hoax some credibility, though, they attributed the novel to a fictitious author named Penelope Ash, who was portrayed by McGrady's sister-in-law during the book's promotional campaign. So she literally stepped in and pretended to be this woman, Penelope Ash, like when they were doing interviews and stuff. And the publishers of the novel actually did not know the true nature of the project. Like, they didn't know that it was this fake thing, intentionally bad. And they marketed Naked Came the Stranger as a serious erotic novel. To the astonishment of McGrady and his team, the book quickly gained traction. Readers devoured the salacious content, and critics who were in on the joke praised its audacious satire. So critics were briefed on it by these writer friends of theirs and were told, oh, please give it a glowing review because, you know, we need that in order to make it look good and then kind of like con people into continuously buying it. Anyway, so the novel then from there, after these like fictitious critics made these fictitious reviews, and then, you know, readers started like, you know, grabbing it off the shelf when they saw that it was, you know, being highly reviewed and revered. They climbed the bestseller lists, and soon the truth behind the creation began to leak. When the hoax was finally fully revealed, it sparked a media frenzy. The public was both amused and shocked by the audacity of the journalists to do this. Some critics denounced the deception, while others hailed it as a brilliant commentary on the state of contemporary literature. So people were kind of split. Like, was it right? Was it, you know, was it a good thing to do? Was it a bad thing to do? So the story of Naked Came the Stranger became as famous as the book itself, illustrating the thin, fine line between high art and lowbrow entertainment. And kind of just goes to show that, like, this is my personal take, that, you know, the way you market something, like, if you market it and you get, like, all, for example, if you're, you know, there's a really bad movie out there, like a bad plot, just a bad story, but you get the most star-studded names, like you get Scarlett Johansson, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet, like, you get, those are just the first two that came to my mind, like, Brad Pitt, I don't know, like, all these, like, names that have been around for a while and have done such, you know, have won awards and done very big projects. If you get those names on the bad script, it at least will do well because of that. So it's like, is the movie really good, or is it just, you know, kind of, it's deceiving because it has all these like big names, or these fake, or these real critics made these fake reviews. Like, the way you market something, you can even, like, something really bad could become a household name based on how you market it. Like, it really can. Anyway, in the end, Naked Came the Stranger, the fake book, succeeded beyond its creator's wildest dreams. It became a cultural phenomenon, a testament to the power of satire, and a cheeky reminder that sometimes even the most outlandish ideas can strike a chord with the public. The novel remains a fascinating footnote in literary history, a prank that turned into a provocative social experiment, highlighting the unpredictable nature of taste and the enduring appeal of a scandal. So between the Northwest Pacific tree octopus, the spaghetti trees, Mary Toft, the rabbit lady, and the novel Naked Came the Stranger, I hope you stop to at least take a beat when you hear something new that sounds too good to be true. These days, all of our information is sensationalized, like everything we see on TikTok nowadays, so it's more important than ever to try to come to your own conclusions based on your own knowledge and research. You just can't believe everything you hear. A good dose of pragmatism will do you good, because you never know who's trying to bamboozle you. You really don't. So, guys, that was an episode on the history of the hoax, some very famous hoaxes, some hoaxes you probably haven't heard of before, and, yeah, just some nice little micro stories that you can tell at parties. So thanks for listening, everyone. I'll be back next week with another episode. This next episode upcoming is focused on, actually, the Titanic. Once again, I have another Titanic story coming for you next week, which I know a lot of people loved the last time. So thank you guys so much for listening. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bilotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel. because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.